Bar Harbor's Best by Wojela. Read by Rhea314. George Horbeck was 79 when the busboy forgot to stamp out his cigarette embers before he tossed the contents of the ashtray. Nobody got hurt, thank heaven, but George's kids lived in Miami now, and Mary'd been gone for 8 years, and he'd only stayed because of the place. So when George took a look around the bar's smoke-blackened interior and announced to the general audience that, well, Florida sounded better and better these days, no one was much surprised. When Joe Zwizdiak, who had taken over his father's real estate office, announced that not 3 weeks later, Rodney McKay bought the place and was coming home after 6 years of doing God knows what, Bar Harbor's collective jaw hit the ground so hard that John Shepherd swore he saw the pier shudder. And if Jeannie Miller, née McKay, was letting her husband run most of the errands, nobody commented much. At least not when Caleb could hear. John wasn't actually in town when the renovation crew arrived. About the first time the truck rolled in and started hauling out the old Victorian fixtures, John was out with Sam somewhere in the middle of Frenchman Bay, listening to the engine chug and pretending like hell he hadn't just found himself downwind of a puking 10-year-old. "Sorry," he said, his face in the towel. Sam just hummed. He gave her a pat, shrugged, and went back out to take the tiller from Elizabeth, who hadn't even paused for breath in her monologue. By the time they got back, Taylor was standing at the edge of the pier, which was good because that meant she and Elizabeth could handle the tourists and John could start cleaning up. The sooner he got that done, the more likely it was he could take Jumper out and catch the edge of the evening breeze before it died completely. It didn't take him long despite the puke, and he was grinning with anticipation as he stowed the gangplank and jumped up onto the dock. "Night, babe," he said to Sam as he checked the boat over one last time. Turning around, he found Taylor and Elizabeth watching him with near-identical smiles. "You know," Elizabeth teased, "if you treated all the girls that way, they'd be lining up for miles." "Hey," he protested, "Sam's a lady." "The Miss Samantha," Taylor said precisely, "is a Coast Guard certified lobster passenger boat, and all the eligible women in Bar Harbor have given up hope that you will ever transfer your affections onto any other object." John just laughed. Taylor turned back to Elizabeth. "We should bring something." "Vodka," Elizabeth answered. "Vodka and chocolate. I'd vote for wine, but she owns a vineyard, and beer's probably isn't a good choice." "Probably not," Taylor sighed. "I've talked to Caleb, and he says he'll take Madison out for the evening." John looked at the two of them completely lost. Is there a problem?" Elizabeth glanced at him, lips pursed. "Not for us, but Jeannie's had better days." He liked Jeannie Miller and Caleb and Madison, who'd had better sea legs than many adults, and who, at 10, wanted to be a marine biologist and spent as much time as her parents would allow hanging around the Atlantis Whale Watch Company's office. Last year, Elizabeth had let her help give one of the lobster seal trip lectures, and Maddie had practically levitated with glee. "Yeah," John said, raising an eyebrow. "Caleb was a good guy, good company. Tell Caleb to bring Maddie on over. I was going to take the jumper out anyway. They can come for a sail. Wind's good, and maybe he'll tell me what's going on," he finished, grinning. Taylor smiled back warmly, then sober. "There's not much to tell," she said quietly, "except that Rodney McKay didn't just buy George's pub. He's moving back in to run it." "Oh." John considered that news item as he watched the two women leave, heads bent toward each other as they walked along the pier. When they reached Elizabeth's car, he shrugged and ran a hand through his hair and went to order pizza. Veggie, he thought. That way he could bring it aboard and everybody could eat. Rodney McKay had been a consternation in Bar Harbor for nearly a decade, having left a good 3 years before John had even set foot in the place. Nobody talked about him much, but when they did, it wasn't anything like the mixture of pity and affection that usually accompanied mention of his sister. The little John knew had been plucked up from Taylor and Elizabeth, who'd moved to start Atlantis not long after Rodney disappeared, and who'd taken to Jeannie like ducks to water. He met Jeannie not long after stumbling into town, barely honorable discharge at his heels, thankful for the sight of water after the endless dust and desert of Afghanistan. "Nice to meet you," had been all Jeannie had said when they first met, a 3-year-old Maddie screaming bloody murder in her stroller as Jeannie stood under the office awning waiting to meet Elizabeth for a late lunch. John had answered, hoping she hadn't noticed his rather dubious glance at the kid. He stuck his hand out. "You too." She looked at him sharply, then laughed, not unkindly. "It's more fun when they're not yelling," she confided. And then Elizabeth showed up, and they hurried off to lunch. He liked her laugh, and mentioned it to Taylor after. Taylor had known John since high school, and learned to read between the lines, thus sparing John the need to actually articulate certain questions, for which he remained intensely thankful. She should laugh more, she had said. But it has been a difficult few years. John had looked at her and she continued. Jeannie's parents owned McKay Vineyards. They moved here when she was and her brother were young, to follow her father's dream. But their mother was never happy here, and left when Jeannie was in high school. Her father is growing old, and her brother, Rodney, ran the winery for several years before. But then, well, there was an argument. He just left after Madison was born, and Jeannie has had the running of things ever since. It's been hard work. Her father had great plans, but the wrong climate, and the vines only began to succeed once they changed grapes. Another argument, Taylor had added, frowning. Ah, John said, knowing something about arguments. Taylor's mouth had quirked. Yes, she agreed. But Caleb is good for her, and she herself is very stubborn. I think she has taken a shine to you. At that point, John had muttered something about needing to check on the boat for the next tour and left. He saw Jeannie when she came to meet someone for lunch, or occasionally just to sit and chat, and they got to know each other in bits and pieces. Later that year, when both Taylor and Elizabeth had left town for Thanksgiving, he'd come home on Wednesday night to Jeannie's peremptory message on his machine, commandeering him to appear for Thursday dinner or else. He'd gone. 7 years later, John hadn't learned much more about her brother and hadn't really felt the need to push, but he had met the elder McKay on multiple occasions. He wasn't an easy person, and John, who knew something about having difficult parents, thought maybe he could fill in a few of the blanks. Mr. McKay had died the previous winter. John had gone to the service awkward and stiff, in a suit he'd kept for that sort of thing. He'd taken a seat in the back of the church and paged along in the order of service, distracted by some guy he didn't know fidgeting in a pew across the aisle. The service had ended and the pallbearers had taken the coffin out. Caleb had been holding a front corner. He caught sight of the fidgety guy and started. Jeannie, close behind, had actually stopped short, eyes wide, which was when John had figured it out, because the guy across the aisle might have had short brownish hair and broad shoulders, but he also had Jeannie's eyes, huge and blue and really bad at bluffing. It had to be McKay. John hadn't gone to the cemetery, but he couldn't shake the kind of crumpled look on the guy's face. So, when he and Elizabeth had gone out with Sam the next day, scouting new routes for the spring, he decided to say something. Yes, Elizabeth had sighed. That was Rodney. He's left again. And that had been that, until now. Contrary to his father's opinion on the subject, life as a cheap skipper for the Atlantis Whale Watching Company was hardly a sinecure. They had a rough couple of weeks just as the season got going. Too much rain meant empty tours. Then, just as the sky cleared, an accident caused some dumb college kids and too much booze that forced them to haul Sam out of the water for repairs that cost them a good week's income. They all took it hard. Taylor went quiet. Elizabeth upped her Diet Coke habit so much she practically vibrated in place. John went out on the puddle jumper, the 30-footer he'd bought 2 years ago out of hazard pay he refused to touch, and that Taylor and Elizabeth refused to let him plow into the business because he's already paid equal to their share. When he'd first sewn up 7 years ago, Afghanistan a far too recent memory, he tried to bully Taylor into letting him transfer that money to the business. He'd known even then it was a lost cause. He and Taylor met in high school. John's dad had been at Fort Meade years back, and there were jobs for ex-military consultants in the D.C. metro area. John's mom had loved Annapolis, and the drive wasn't out of the ordinary, so that's where they'd landed. Taylor's father was a prof, had just gotten a job at St. John's College, and she had been a dyed-in-the-world environmentalist. John had fallen in with her at the very first because they were both new kids, and then because there was something about Taylor he needed, for lack of a better word. She was quiet and self-assured, and content to just let him be, except when she had an agenda, which is how John ended up bamboozled into working for a Chesapeake Bay Foundation in his freshman summer. He'd spent 3 weeks slogging around in marshes when some guy co-opted him as labor on a foundation-sponsored sail around the bay. John, who'd been sure since he was 5 that all he wanted to do was fly, had been hooked. If he couldn't have an airplane, a sailboat out on the water with the wind stinging his face was the next best thing. As far as he was concerned, he'd never have figured that out but for Taylor. He owed her for that. They'd gone their separate ways for college. John had been academy-bound, and the flying made up for the lack of water. Taylor'd gone to Brown and met Elizabeth. He'd kept in touch, more or less, had met Elizabeth a rare handful of times when he was home on leave and Taylor had dragged her back to Annapolis. The two of them were a dangerous pair, two environmental studies majors on a mission. The force of their combined determination could probably move mountains. He liked Elizabeth immediately. It had only been natural to sweep her into the same category as Taylor, to write both of them, rather than just one, knowing the gossip would always get passed along anyway. Elizabeth wrote him to say that Taylor's brother had gotten himself in with a bad crowd. Taylor wrote him to say that Simon had left Elizabeth at the altar. He had written back with promises of death threats and payback as appropriate. He'd been on his way to Afghanistan when they decided to buy out a whale-watching company in Bar Harbor. He'd written when it fell apart a little more than the basic facts. He wasn't sure why he had, only that if he could tell anyone, it'd be them. Taylor had written back with a pamphlet and an address and a comment that they'd just had a skipper quit. It'd been an easy choice. 7 years went by before he realized it. Even after 7 years of practice, though, it wasn't an easy business. Though, and while John loved the boat and the water and the outdoors, Taylor and Elizabeth had their hearts tied up in the whole thing. So it was a blow losing Sam to repairs when she hit water again. He couldn't complain when they ran a hard schedule for the next month or so, cramming extra tours and charters and spending his spare time standing next to Elizabeth and charming the tour operators and travel agents that came to scout them out and compare them to their competition. All of which meant it was the end of May before John had a chance to wander down Maine to take a look at what had become of Mr. Harbeck's old pub. As far as he knew, McKay wasn't back in town yet, but apparently someone knew was in town, because John knew most of Bar Harbor's year-round population, and he'd never seen anyone quite like the mammoth dreadlocked guy, wearing what looked like a scabbard and standing outside the restaurant arguing, apparently, with the timing of the delivery of a refrigerator. John spent a minute across the street admiring what they'd done with the place. The old Victorian had a fresh coat of paint and new windows, but from what he could see, it looked like they kept the interior much the same, just polished up. The guy across the way ended his phone call with what sounded like a growl, and John sauntered over to meet the neighbors. "Nice place," he extended a hand. The other guy sized him up. "I run the whale-watching boat." "Ronan Dex," the guy said after a minute, and reached out to shake. John manfully suppressed a wince. "Gonna run the kitchen." "You're a chef," John looked him over. "Really?" Ronan Dex reached for the scabbard thing at his hip and pulled out a wickedly sharp chef's knife and tested the edge. "Yep." "Cool." John looked at the restaurant again, looked at the sign, red and black outside the window. "No double billing?" "Nah," Ronan said. "Don't really care." "No? If they don't like the food, they won't come back. Besides," Ronan shrugged, sheathed the knife, "it wasn't worth the argument." John grinned. "Pick your battles much?" Ronan bared his teeth, smiling. "I won the wine bar." "You fought about a wine bar." John raised an eyebrow. Ronan stopped smiling. "McKay likes beer." "Huh." John mulled that over, tucked it away. "So, what do I get if I tell you who gets the best catch?" "You'll get more if you show me where to get it myself." John laughed. "Yeah, I can do that," he said. He liked Ronan. He was good on the jumper, took direction well and learned fast. And damn could he cook. Which made definite change for the better compared to John's steady diet of things that came out of the freezer. There was an awkward encounter when he and Ronan bumped into Jeannie, and introductions went around. John stopped by the vineyard that night not to apologize, but to say something. He knocked on the door and jammed his hands in his pockets. Jeannie answered, hands covered in flour, eyes a little pink. John followed her back into the kitchen, stopping briefly to bribe Maddie with the promise of a day digging clams. He looked around the place, settling down in a kitchen chair, as Jeannie went back to kneading bread. They didn't say anything for a bit, not till John shifted uncomfortably and said, "Jeannie, look." She stopped kneading. "John," she said, "I don't hate him much. I don't expect you to hate him. Ronan is a little terrifying on first encounter, but I have no intention of turning this into a Sharks versus Jets." John paused, considering. "I was only going to say that I speak he swear to hate all his friends if you wanted me to. You're the one inflicting musical theater on us all." Jeannie laughed. "Well, that's comforting. Plus, and I hate to say this, but Ronan can totally take Caleb. This probably makes me the world's worst wife, but you're probably right." She smiled and looked at him steadily. "John, I don't know why my brother's coming back. I don't know what's going on in that thick head of his. I know he owes me one hell of an apology, but what happens will happen." John shrugged, stuck his hands back in his pockets. "Yeah, well, I still promise to beat him up at recess if he makes you cry." Jeannie laughed. "I'll keep that in mind." John didn't ask about McKay to the mutual exasperation of Elizabeth and Taylor. He didn't really ask about the pub at all, although Ronan wasn't deaf or stupid, and John figured he'd picked up on at least some of the gossip from just living in the town. Still, it was kind of so surprised when he and Ronan were out on the water one early morning in July, and Ronan said, "McKay gets in tomorrow." John blinked and got on with tacking. The wind was fickle this morning, and he was having trouble catching it. "Yeah?" "Yeah." Ronan ducked as the boom swung over. "We open in a week. He's coming in to get the beer started." "Huh." John tied off the line. "Ought to tell Jeannie, I guess." "Yeah." Ronan leaned forward, hands on his knees. "Shepherd," he said. And John stopped, watching the horizon long enough to look his way. Ronan's face was impassive. "McKay, he's not a bad guy. He's loud, and sometimes an asshole. But he's good at what he does, and he's loyal. I think he wants to come home." John thought about that, thought about the only time he'd ever seen Rodney McKay, and the look on his face when he saw his sister. "Huh," he said again, and the wind changed, and he had to tack, and that was the end of the conversation. Ronan pretty much disappeared for the rest of the week, which was hardly surprising. John passed the word along to Taylor and Elizabeth and stayed the hell out of it. At least he didn't go in Friday evening, at which point his business partners collected him off the dock and informed him in no uncertain terms that he was going to provide their excuse for checking out the newly minted McKay's public house on its opening night. "You like Ronan," Elizabeth reasoned. "It's only logical you'd want to wish him well." "I agree," Taylor chimed in. "It would be odd for you to stay away." John had already wished Ronan luck a few days ago, and the last thing he himself would have wanted was yet another set of eyes come to stare at the returning prodigal. John also had, however, a healthy sense of self-preservation, and it was currently informing him that the repercussions of saying no in this situation would be swift, possibly painful, and entirely unsuccessful. He gave up when Taylor handed him a duffel with clean shirt khakis and shoved him in towards the office to change. It was, in the end, a decent evening. The food was good, which was no surprise. The beer was good, a welcome change from the standard draft offerings available everywhere else in this town. The best part by far, from John's perspective, was watching the antics of Rodney McKay, person non grata, keeper of the bar, and possibly the snarkiest beer aficionado on the face of the planet. John ordered a beer and got it, without drawing fire. The table next to them ordered a bottle of red, which came delivered by McKay himself, all waving hands in derision, paired with a lecture on precisely why House Amber would have been a significantly better choice. The highlight, however, was McKay's reaction when some poor waiter delivered an order for a screwdriver. The resultant lecture on the hazards of citrus left the restaurant in an absolute hush that persisted for a good 3 minutes. Taylor and Elizabeth looked a little shell-shocked by the time they walked out the door, the three of them heading their separate ways. He could hardly blame them. It wasn't exactly what he'd expected. Frankly, John wasn't sure what he'd been expecting, given that all he knew about McKay was that he'd left his sister in the lurch, and that he'd stayed away for 10 years, that Ronan thought he was kind of an asshole but really a decent guy, and that when he'd seen his sister in the church at their father's funeral, he'd looked like a person with more than a few regrets who didn't know how to fix any of them. John understood about regrets, at least. McKay's opened, and the season stayed busy, and life pretty much went on as normal. Ronan showed up every so often for a morning sale, and Maddie showed up so often she was practically regular crew. John stopped by the restaurant now and again for a drink after work. The beer was really good. If McKay had spoken to his sister, nobody knew about it. John drank his beer and didn't ask questions. The morning Rodney McKay came storming up to the jumper as John was coming into the dock was, as a result, kind of unexpected. It had been a good morning, just him and the water, and he was pleasantly mellow. "You," McKay said, leveling a finger at him. John blinked and went back to tying off. "You," McKay said again. And John reminded himself that he was staying well out of it. "John Shepherd," he said calmly, and went to grab the sail bags. "Nice to meet you." "I know who you are," McKay blustered above deck. "Stop giving Ronan ideas." "What?" John stopped partway up the stairs. "What the hell are you talking about?" He started rolling the sail and cursed when he fumbled the stay. "Oh, for God's sake," McKay said, and clambered aboard. "Are you entirely stupid?" John just stared, baffled, as McKay finished off the mainsail and reached for the cover. "McKay," he said slowly, "what the hell are you doing?" "I'm about to stow your jib, since clearly otherwise we will be here all day before I can finally have your undivided attention, which is frankly time I don't have, since my executive chef is about to mutiny if I don't go looking for local wines to add to our beverage list, which is clearly an idea that you put in his head and which you need to take out of his head right now, because I'm not interested in succumbing to your machinations." John sat. "Okay, what?" McKay tossed the sail below. "Ronan thinks," he said slowly, over-enunciating like he was speaking to a toddler, "that I need to stock McKay Vineyard wines at the wine bar." The last two words looked like they caused him physical pain. "He is refusing to plan today's menu until I agree to that insane idea. Clearly, this is because he is friends with you. The entire town knows that my sister has practically adopted you. So whatever ridiculous scheme you have cooked up to reunite our incredibly dysfunctional family unit, I want you to call it off right now and go explain to my recalcitrant chef, who was, may I add, my friend first, that it is a terrible idea and that everyone should keep their nose out of other people's business." McKay paused for breath, finger quivering where it pointed at John's forehead. John, for his part, just stared as he replayed McKay's monologue. It didn't make any more sense the second time through. He shook his head and locked the hatch, then stepped onto the dock. "McKay," he managed, "you're completely insane, you know that, right?" McKay made a sort of strangled noise. John kept going, walking back up the dock. "I like Jeannie a lot, but trust me on this one. I have no idea what you're talking about." Behind him, he heard the boat shift against the bumpers on the pylons and McKay's footsteps on the dock hurrying up behind him. He turned around. McKay was right behind him, unnervingly close. John took a step back. "You should know, though," he said. "Jeannie's pretty great, and she doesn't hate you. Much," he added after a moment's consideration. "So you might consider giving it a shot, I mean." He finished uncomfortably, watching something in McKay deflate like a leaky balloon. "Not that it's my business or anything." McKay stood there a moment, looking almost baffled, until he jerked his chin up with a gesture that made John's chest hurt a little. Just a little. "Well, then," McKay said at last, "just so we're clear on that point." He snapped and marched off. John watched him go, then shook his head and headed off to work. John stopped by the pub two nights later. He wasn't incredibly hungry, not really, but it had been a busy day and August was coming up, which meant the tail end of the vacation season, so life was probably going to get busier, which meant he could really use a beer. McKay eyed him, his face watchful and thin-lipped. John just drummed on the bar and smiled lazily. "What do you want?" McKay eventually demanded. "Relax, McKay," John scanned the beer list. "I'm only here for a drink." He tossed the card aside. "What do you like?" "Me?" McKay asked and stared at him, clearly nonplussed. "You," John answered. "You make them, after all. I figure you ought to know." "Well, yes, clearly," McKay sputtered, then rolled his eyes. "But they're all superior. I mean, really, if you don't know what your own tastes are, then asking me certainly isn't going to help. I mean, for crying out loud, what do you usually drink?" That, John thought, was just too easy. "Oh, I don't know," he drawled. "I'm pretty much a bud kind of guy." "Oh my God," Rodney snapped, and in short order a row of glasses was laid out on the bar before he even paused for breath in the middle of a diatribe against American-style lagers and the homogenization of the American palate. John just grinned and let him run with it. By the time Rodin left the sous chef to close up shop, he and McKay, whatever, just call me Rodney, had sampled and resampled a sizable portion of the bar. McKay, he thought, ambling home in a comforting glow, really wasn't a terrible guy. At least not when it came to beer, anyway. He loved it, that much was clear. Loved brewing like John loved flying, or sailing, he corrected muzzily. Rodney knew the hops, the process, the styles and brews, and everything else, most of which had been pretty far over John's head, and man, McKay had an opinion on all of it. It brought him to life, eyes bright, hands punctuating, wide mouth scowling and grinning in turns. John was still laughing about it the next morning, even with the hangover. August came in hot and dry, and John started showing up at the bar more often. He couldn't help it, not really. McKay was really fun in a bizarre kind of way, and he was easy to be around, easier even than Taylor in some ways, because subtext was just a non-entity as far as Rodney was concerned. John carefully did not think about the ways in which Rodney was harder to be around. He very carefully did not think about blue eyes and a solid frame and broad hands. He did not think about that at all. Halfway through the month, John invited Rodney out in the jumper. It had been a casual invitation. He dropped it into the conversation without pause to consider. John hadn't expected the look of surprise on McKay's face, or the delight. It made him wonder why he hadn't done it sooner. McKay showed up early the next day, which was a surprise. He had his face buried in a vat of coffee, which wasn't. They opened the jumper without much talking. John out of inclination, and McKay apparently out of desire to approach complete consciousness from the tangent. Clearly Rodney knew his way around. John didn't ask. He didn't need to, as it turned out. They were out by Egg Rock Light when McKay broke the silence. "I used to love doing this as a kid." John looked at him in surprise. McKay was watching the shoreline. Sailing, I mean. I liked the precision of it, the independence. He went quiet. Eventually John asked, Why'd you stop? There was too much to learn. At the vineyard? My father, he always had places they wanted me to be. I couldn't get good enough to join a competitive team, and a boat or a club membership wasn't an affordable investment. Not when the vines weren't doing well. McKay's mouth turned down. I tried to go, in Oregon, in Portland, but it's not the same. It's not like here. John watched the lighthouse. No, guess not. Guess he had to go, though. Rodney looked at him. John kept his eyes in the squat cream and brown building. Rodney looked away. I did. He was wrong and stubborn, and there wasn't anything to be done except watch him try vines that didn't work and make wines that had no one in their right mind would buy. I started to hate it. There wasn't anything to do but go. Tough on your sister. McKay flinched. That doesn't make it wrong. That doesn't make it right. No, Rodney said quietly. But I came back for a reason. I just didn't realize I had a reason until I came back for the funeral. And then I had to go. He gestured vaguely, tie things up. Before I changed my mind, so I left. I mean, I was leaving anyway. This just speeded it up. John let himself grin just a little. Pissed them off there too, huh, McKay? Rodney scowled. Hardly. The brewery decided to go public, and I'm not going to water down my beer just because some pain-in-the-ass board of directors thinks it's more marketable. The ensuing rant lasted them all the way back to shore. When Rodney finally sucked it up and went to visit the Millers, it was more anticlimactic than anything else. It was for John, anyway, although he derived a fair amount of pleasure from the highly suspicious looks he got from Taylor and Elizabeth for the next week. By the time Labor Day rolled around, John had worked up enough courage to admit to himself that he had a problem and that that problem in question had everything to do with Rodney McKay. Admitting it to himself wasn't really the problem at all, actually. He'd lost that fight the third time he found himself in the shower imagining a very different hand jerking him off. It was easier to just give up, and certainly more interesting since his brain apparently had no shortage of interesting fantasies when Rodney McKay was concerned. More concerning was the fact that John was doing a particularly good job of hiding his interest. He knew Taylor had noticed, which meant in turn Elizabeth knew. He wasn't sure about Jeannie, although Madison had commented one afternoon about the fact that her Uncle Rodney always seemed to be around, and John had choked on a mouthful of soda. Jeannie hadn't said anything, hadn't even looked at him oddly apart from the one slightly wry smile that could have been sympathy as much as anything else. She and Rodney were working out their differences, and Rodney had agreed to put the McKay wines in rotation and maybe, possibly, give an interview to up publicity. But the whole reconciliation thing was still occasionally a loud process. Ronan wouldn't have said anything anyway. That left only Rodney to worry about, and Rodney couldn't bluff worth a damn. John had caught Rodney looking at him a little oddly of late, just every once in a while, with an expression on his face that John had never seen before. He thought about staying away. He had a regular seat at the damn bar at this point, but he liked McKay, and that was pretty much what it boiled down to. So he tried not to act too strangely and tried not to notice the occasional weird look from McKay. He'd been just about to pull his hair out by the roots from pent-up sexual frustration when, 2 days into September, in the middle of Labor Day weekend, Hurricane Pablo took a sharp right turn just south of Baltimore and headed straight from the Maine coast, which had not been expecting the visit. Pablo? Rodney expostulated, standing in Jeannie's kitchen while they made plans. Who the hell names a New England hurricane Pablo? Could be worse, John answered, distracted. Could have been Van. I like Pablo, Ronan said from the sink, next to Caleb, where they were making some sort of enormous casserole for dinner, and leftovers if the power went out. Focus, please, Elizabeth snapped, phone in hand. No one's going to be able to haul Sam in time. They've got too many vacationers calling it in as it is. Taylor swore. We should have left 2 days ago. We couldn't afford to, and you know it. It's why we took the risk in the first place. Betting the damn thing wouldn't turn this way. It's okay, John said. We've got time, we've got anchors, and we've got line. I'll take a route. Either we'll find a hole or we'll drop anchor. You realize that you're talking about the boat in third person again, Jeannie said, trying to laugh, but her eyes were worried. Shepard, John, Caleb turned around. What about the jumper? John sucked in a breath. He'd been trying not to think about it. I'll put slack lines in before I head out. She'll be fine. Caleb looked dubious. Really, this isn't the apocalypse. It's just a lot of wind. He wasn't exactly persuading himself either, but Maddie was in the kitchen and he was not going to scare her. What we don't want is anyone out on the water that doesn't have to be. Agreed, Elizabeth stood. All right, Taylor and I will drop you off and grab Water, batteries, and bread. Anything else? I'll make you a list. Jeannie grabbed a piece of paper and a pencil. You're completely insane, Rodney said, staring at him, blue eyes wide. But you love me anyway, John quipped, only it didn't come out quite right. Rodney's eyes went even bigger, and John fled for the car. He saw Madison in the hallway on his way out and stopped long enough to give her a hug and tell her not to worry. She didn't look convinced. By the time they made it to the pier and loosened up Jumper and checked Sam's lines and anchors, the chop was kicking up. They'd had a fair amount of warning, and John was deeply grateful for the joys of modern weather forecasting. But they wasted time betting against the storm's track. Looking for someone to haul the boats by now, the harbor's traffic was pretty thick, and the close-in spots were gone. On the way out, John saw three or four boats docked to at anchor that looked less than secure. He did not think about the puddle jumper. He did not think about it a lot. He found a decent anchorage and started making Sam secure as he listened to the weather reports. By the time he was satisfied, the clouds overhead were dark and the rain had started to kick in. When the call came over the radio, the chop was high enough that he'd already loosened one of the anchor lines and was considering adding more slack to the second. "Shepherd, come in," Rodney said, and John knew enough about fear to be able to identify the tone in his voice. He scrambled for the handset. "McKay, this is Shepherd." "Oh, thank God," Rodney breathed, and John heard something rustle. "Shepherd, Maddie's gone missing." It was like a punch to the gut. He stared at the radio, hands tight on the counter, and listened to the wind howling through the glass. "Shepherd?" Rodney asked, voice tight. He managed to breathe again. "Tell me you didn't just say that, McKay." "Trust me, I wish I hadn't." John never had heard McKay sound so miserable. "When the hell did you last see her?" he snarled. "Funny," Rodney bit back. "I was going to ask you the same question." "Okay," John said, breathing hard, running a hand through his hair. "I saw her. She was in the kitchen when we were planning, and then I saw her in the hallway on my way out." And then John's very slow brain finally got 2 + 2 = 4. "Fuck." "You know where she is?" Rodney demanded. "She's on the fucking jumper," John snarled. It started to rain. "She was in the kitchen when we were talking about the jumper, and that kid loves the damn boat almost as much as I do. God damn it, if her parents don't kill her first, I'll be waiting in line." "Yes, we'll take a number," Rodney snapped. "I'm going to go get her." "There's a key under the rock outside of the Atlantis' office," John answered. "Get her off the boat and get the hell back to Jeannie's." "Unlike some individuals of my acquaintance, I am not insane as to want to ride out a hurricane on a boat," Rodney replied. "McKay out." The line went dead. John moved, eventually, went to check the lines and put up the storm covers on the windows. When he came back inside, soaked to the bone, he sat down and stared at the floor, listening to the wind and the rain and the weather reports until he got fed up and switched off the ladder. Outside, Pablo howled. He wasn't sure how much time had passed when he got the next call. "John?" came Maddie's voice. "John, are you there, please?" He lunged for the handset. "Maddie?" he demanded, running a hand through his hair. "Maddie, is that you?"
"It's me," she quavered. He took a deep breath.
"Madison Avenue, am I glad to hear from you. Are you home and safe?"
"No," she sobbed.
John tried really, really hard not to panic. Hey, Squirt, it's okay. Just tell me where you are. Deep breaths, okay?"
"I'm on the jumper."
The radio crackled, and John heard Rodney's voice in the background. "Maddie, let me talk to your uncle, okay?" He heard a sniffle. "Let me talk to Rodney, Maddie. It's going to be okay, I promise." Right after I throttle another McKay, he thought, and swore as Sam gave a particularly sickening heave. "Shepherd, are you there?" Rodney said. "McKay?" John attempted not to growl. "Why the heck are you out in the jumper?"
"Trust me, Shepherd," Rodney answered. "It wasn't my first choice. But there's this little thing called storm surge that's presently flooding your office and the downtown road, so believe it or not, this was in fact our best option."
John hauled in another breath and discarded the first two answers that popped into his head. "Where exactly are you?"
"We're out in the harbor, as far away from anyone else as I can manage. We'll be fine, John, I think."
He added, and that note of panic was not at all reassuring. "McKay," he snapped, "you're going to be fine, do you understand me? You're in the harbor, you're anchored down, you're wearing life vests, right?"
"Oh my God," Rodney retorted, at least a little of the panic was gone. "What kind of idiot do you think I am?"
"The kind I will meet on the dock with Maddie after this goddamn hurricane gets the hell out of here, do you understand me?"
"Perfectly," came the answer. "McKay out."
John sat back and listened to the wind. "Shepherd?" said the radio in McKay's voice several hours later. He stared at it, confused. The wind was still howling. "Shepherd, come in."
"McKay," he responded. "You okay? Where's Maddie? Why are you whispering?"
"She's asleep."
Ronnie answered, sounding distracted. I don't want to wake her. Shepherd. Ronnie tried again, voice thready. Shepherd, this is a really very small boat. Hey, John said, aiming for reassuring. Don't knock the jumper. Rodney said nothing. Rodney, he asked. Hey, buddy, you there? Look, McKay, it won't be that much longer. Really, listen. The wind's starting to die down.
Maybe, John hoped.
Yeah, Rodney said at last. Yeah, you're right. Sorry about that. Look, Shepherd, I... He paused. John, did you mean it? John Shepherd had spent the vast part of his day worrying about the multiple boats and 10-year-old wannabe marine biologist and stupidly heroic brewers and so on. He figured he was allowed to have one moment of unvarnished honesty.
Yeah, McKay, I did.
And then, because John Shepherd was cold and wet and partially seasick, and also probably a little bit terrified, he said, I'll see you on the dock. Shepherd out, and stared at the radio. The end, in the end, was kind of anticlimactic. It took Shepherd something that felt like forever to get Sam back to the dock, and by the time he closed her back up and stumbled up to where Rodney and a very much more subdued Maddie were waiting, it was all he could do to keep his eyes open. When Jeannie and Caleb pulled up and bundled them all into the car, Rodney's having been flooded out, he and McKay woke at the vineyard moments later with their heads slumped together. John didn't mind. In fact, he would have much preferred if he could stay that way. Maddie's parents bundled her off to bed, and John and Rodney presented themselves to Taylor and Elizabeth and Ronan, before stumbling up the stairs in the candlelight since the power was out, and likely to remain so for some time, according to Taylor. With seven people in a house that normally slept three, Jeannie announced, meeting them at the top of the steps, they were just going to have to share. John was too damn tired to do more than suspect her of mischief. When he woke up, finally, the sun was high, and Rodney was shoving his feet into sneakers. Morning, John managed, running a hand over his chin and wincing at the stubble. Rodney's head jerked up so fast, John worried briefly about whiplash. Oh, yes, good morning. Afternoon, actually, but then who's counting? He stopped for breath. Everyone else is out checking up on things, he said, standing. I told Ronan I'd check in on the pub. They left a car, he added, if you'd like to come. John looked at Rodney carefully before he answered, feeling like a man betting double or nothing. What the hell, he said slowly. I could go for a beer. McKay grinned and stood. Come on then, let's get a move on. The pub was dark when they fumbled their way inside. The emergency lights were dim and the storm covers blocked out the sunlight. John headed up to the attic, which looked intact to his inexpert eye. He met Rodney on the stairs on the way down, opening the door to a suite he lived in. Come on, McKay said, calling John's attention to the two bottles of Magic Hat in his other hand. John followed him up to the kitchen and caught the church key McKay tossed in his direction. He popped the cap and drank, closing his eyes to enjoy the hoppy and sharp taste and the silence and lack of motion under his feet. When he opened them, McKay was standing across the counter from him, just staring. John put the bottle down and tried not to fidget. Good beer, he said eventually. Rodney waved it off. It's a reasonable brew. I don't mind keeping it around. Mine's better, but the draft system's offline because of the power. He went back to watching John. McKay, John said, feeling awkward. Shut up. Ronnie glared at him. Just shut up. What the hell are you doing, McKay? John demanded. Ronnie frowned. I'm trying to figure out exactly how dumb you are. John flushed. He tried to speak, but Ronnie cut him off. No, really, he said. Can I suggest that the next time you attempt to declare your undying affection, you don't do it in the middle of the first hurricane to hit Maine in over 2 decades? John stared. Right, McKay. I'll try and time my inadvertent personal revelations to your personal schedule next time, okay? Go ahead, get snippy, Rodney retorted, and John almost swallowed his tongue at the word snippy. But if you'd understood how to communicate like a normal person, you might find that there are ways of confirming another person's interest that don't involve whispered phone conversations over the radio in the middle of a major weather event. And another thing, Rodney said. Only John had sort of tuned out at that point because his overly tired brain had finally parsed out the first part of that sentence, and he was walking around the counter to corner McKay in the kitchen. McKay, John said, and Rodney paused mid-syllable. What now, Shepherd? Rodney demanded. You never said anything. Rodney goggled at him. I never said anything? I'm sorry you're the one who kept acting all weird, and while I'm very talented with alcohol, I'm not exactly known for my interpersonal skills, if you haven't noticed. So it's not like I had any clue what you were thinking, although I sort of hoped that maybe... But even then, I didn't know. And what did you want me to say? McKay, John said again, close enough to feel the heat of Rodney's body. What? Ronnie asked, eyes wide.
Shut up, John said and kissed him.
Ronnie tasted like beer and salt water and sweat, and something John couldn't put a name to, and he kissed back like he was afraid John was going to slip out of his grasp. He could have stayed there for hours, pouring himself out in an attempt to prove Rodney wrong, until somebody shifted, and their bodies aligned just so, and suddenly they were both frantic and tugging and pulling and twisting their way out of clothing and over to the bed. It was reaction, he thought, stress and tension and fear, and then Rodney did something particularly intelligent with his thumb, and John decided to stop thinking for a while, and said as much to McKay.
Good plan, Rodney gasped over his shoulder. Overrated, mostly, for now, anyway.
At which point John devoted himself to distracting Rodney from the point entirely, which turned out to be an excellent plan for all concerned. Much later, feeling like he never needed to move again, John said, muttering the words against Rodney's forehead,
"Acting weird, huh?"
"To say the least," Rodney mumbled. "Says the man not known for interpersonal skills," John grinned.
"If you ever repeat that, I will pour cyanide in your stout,"
Rodney promised, slurring his words. John just laughed and let himself fall down into sleep after McKay and dreamed of the wind on his face. The end. If you've enjoyed the story, please leave feedback for the author. You can do that at her live journal, omgme2.livejournal.com. Thanks for listening.